the headlines. Iran's parliament overwhelmingly approves a bill aimed at tackling sanctions and what is described as the first practical response to the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist. The UN appeals for a record $35 billion to provide aid in 2021 as the coronavirus pandemic leaves tens of millions of people in crisis. And OPEC members reach a broad consensus on the need to extend oil production cuts for 3 months, if their allies also support such a move. Hello, welcome to Business News. Thanks for joining us. Lead story, Iranian lawmakers have overwhelmingly approved a bill aimed at tackling sanctions imposed on the country. The bill requires the government to pursue uranium enrichment of 20%, but also calls for increasing stockpiles of low-enriched uranium. The bill calls for making use of advanced centrifuges, namely IR-6 and IR-2M types. Iranian lawmakers pushed for the bill following multiple rounds of sanctions that the U.S. imposed after it withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. Under the deal, Iran had agreed on curbs on its nuclear program. The bill follows the Friday assassination of eminent Iranian nuclear and defense scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. An informed source says that the bill is Iran's first practical response to the assassination. Fakhrizadeh is a professor at the University of Tehran. Welcome. We're seeing, obviously, as we have said, this being the first official response to what has happened, the targeted killing and assassination of Mr. Fakhrizadeh, Dr. Fakhrizadeh. So the question now is, who is the audience that Iran is meant for the decisions that they took in Parliament today for them to act on? And does the other party or parties realize the urgency of the matter?
Well, I don't know if they realize the urgency of the matter. I think what the Israelis have done and the U.S. government has done is to shoot themselves in the foot. Iran's nuclear program does not depend on one person, and although Dr. Fakhrizadeh was a very major scientist in Iran and helped with different scientific projects in Iran, Iran's scientific infrastructure and the engineers and practitioners that engage in that infrastructure are quite a lot, and so the result of what the U.S. has done and the Israelis have done is basically creating a martyr out of someone who worked very hard in the last four decades for Iran's scientific advance. This is something they don't realize, that the value of martyrdom in Iranian culture and Islamic culture is quite extensive. So they're damaging themselves by engaging in these type of activities, and they're giving the Iranian parliament an excuse to expand Iran's nuclear program significantly. And now people in Europe or other places that may complain are not going to be entertained, because they had a responsibility to make sure that these type of terrorist activities don't take place. And the complaints from terrorist states generally are not going to be listened to in any significant way. So I think today was an advancement for Iran's national security, and I think this will continue for many years to come.
Well, we're looking at what the title of this whole action plan is, and it was under the framework of how sanctions should be lifted. So if sanctions need to be lifted, can this happen? And also, doesn't it require the U.S. side to comply or to cooperate when it comes to this matter, which then hence brings forward the question of who can the Europeans, for example, talk to? Does it have to be Donald Trump, or does it have to be the incoming U.S. administration, if and when confirmed?
Well, you know, Iran tried the other way, which was giving concessions and following the nuclear agreement and being a nice boy policy, following a nice boy policy. And what did Iran get? More sanctions, more pressures, scientists getting assassinated on the streets. So that was one way. It's not obviously working out. The second way is what Iran is going to do from now on, which is basically follow its national interests when it comes to its nuclear program or other activities, and not really pay attention to countries that have shown and have proven to be enemies of Iran. Why would you want to listen to your enemies when they have proven that that's what they are? And so that's going to go on. Europeans, you know, they're not really any, they don't play any significant role in the world now. Maybe 50 years ago, 100 years ago, they had some significance, but they are totally clueless and powerless in doing anything. They generally listen to what the U.S. says, whether it's the Trump administration or the Biden administration. And so this is a day of freedom for Iran, because at least the people who voted for this bill are free from Europe. They are not going to worry about what Europe does or does not do, or whether they want to talk to Biden or Trump or whoever else. So the policy is shifting. The result of the martyrdom of Dr. Fakhrizadeh is actually going to advance Iran's national security, and his martyrdom is going to mean much more for Iran than when he was alive. And so he's achieving a lot of his goals in martyrdom instead of when he was alive.
Thank you very much for that. Fuad Izzati, professor at the University of Tehran, many thanks. Meanwhile, political analyst Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh says that Iran sees no reason to stay in the 2015 nuclear deal since other signatories have failed to fulfill their commitments.
Iranian parliament, which came to office about 6 months ago, decided to actually take some measures so that to put pressure on the other sides, not to be bullied by the Americans, not to follow illegal sanctions that the Americans have imposed, and take some responsibility vis-a-vis the UN Security Council's resolution. So what we are seeing right now is that the Americans have withdrawn from the JCPOA. They have not implemented a resolution by the United Nations Security Council, and they are even bullying and pressuring the other countries, the other participants of the deal, not to commit that, not to implement that. So it is totally illegal based on the international law, and it is weakening the Security Council of the United Nations. So there remains no reason for Iran to actually to adhere to that deal. Iran is not withdrawing from that. Iran is not exiting the JCPOA. What they are taking is putting conditions, setting conditions for the other side. So if they are doing less, Iran would do even less. That has been the policy for the Iranians from the very beginning. They decided to actually implement this less for less policy.
Well, political commentator Tohid Asadi says a serious lack of commitment by the West has led to a new course of action in Iran.
Truth of the matter again is that the gap and the key gap and the key point of concern was a serious lack of commitment by the West, either in the United States or the European Union, that resulted in new courses of action taken by Iran. You just referred to the recent assassination, and if you just take a look at the response that we heard from the West and the European Union in particular, it was very much, very much low in terms of the scale, and it was not as it was anticipated. So it is an instance of state terrorism, and we know, not as a matter of fact, but there are some evidence to prove that some specific players, including Israeli regime, are behind this attack. But when it came to responses, we had some very slight reaction pertaining to this specific matter. So it is in accordance with the same foreign policy of the European Union that follows the United States and follows pure interests and forgets about human rights and forgets about state terrorism and condemning these brutal, cruel courses of action taken by their own partners.
Iran has once again vowed to bring to justice those behind the assassination of its top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The foreign ministry spokesman said that Iran will certainly punish the perpetrators of the targeted killing, as well as those who ordered it. Saeed Khatibzadeh added that Israel's role in the terror attack, with the support of the U.S., is undeniable. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in a town near the capital, Tehran, on Friday. The foreign ministry spokesman thanked all governments who slammed the assassination, including Iran's Arab neighbors. Khatibzadeh said only one Persian Gulf state did not condemn the assault. He was referring to Saudi Arabia. The EU describes the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as a criminal act, but stops short of pointing the finger at Israel for the atrocity. One EU lawmaker tells Press TV that the murder last Friday near Tehran was designed to stifle efforts to pursue diplomacy with Iran. Jerome Hughes has more.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaak is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States, but also trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder, and what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal?
Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United Nations says that 1 in 33 people around the world will need humanitarian aid next year due to the coronavirus pandemic. According to UN officials, the figure will amount to 235 million people worldwide. They say that's a 40% increase from the number of people in need of aid in 2020. The UN says hunger, conflicts, and climate change have made the situation worse. It says that there's also a risk of famines in countries like Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Yemen. The UN is appealing for more funding by wealthier countries. It says that it has raised only half of the $35 billion funding required to reach out to those in need. Since the coronavirus hit France nearly 1 year ago, and with the second lockdown in 6 months, unemployment and poverty are rising dramatically in the European Union. Chris Dunhend has more.
A new kind of the French population is falling into a state of poverty. That's the conclusion of a poll institute, Ipsos, the Observatory of Inequalities, and of important humanitarian associations like the Resto du Coeur and Secours Populaire. They sound the alarm. The health crisis caused by the coronavirus is provoking an unprecedented social crisis. A new kind of people stand in line today for clothes and food assistance.
More and more people are coming here, especially since 3 weeks, because it's getting cold. We have started distribution points for women and older people, and we see that more women and older persons are coming. Now we have also more and more young people, young mothers, and students, so there is more diversity in the people coming here.
Rachid Arar is the founder and responsible of this Open Table Humanitarian Association. Since long time, he is heavily invested in aid for people in need.
Those who had small jobs of 2 or 3 hours a day, they sunk. Everybody is at the bottom. We picked up many of them. They were on a tightrope and they tipped over. We see a lot of them.
1 in 3 French persons has now less income than before the COVID crisis. Those who still have work fear to lose their job. Mariette was a saleswoman. Her business closed during the first lockdown. Now she depends from the food distribution. She crossed the line.
These people emptied their savings. They consumed the last tin can before coming here to us. At the end, when they had nothing left, they came here and stood in line. We notice people who come here for the first time. The misery today is screaming. We hear it. Hunger is yelling. Before, hunger and the misery were silent and hidden. Today, people are not ashamed anymore because they are in a survival mode.
The number of persons who receive food aid increased with 30% since the COVID crisis. Old people are paying a heavy tribute in matter of health, but young people will suffer more from the economic impact of the COVID crisis. Half of the poor in France is less than 30 years old. Since the beginning of the COVID crisis and the two lockdowns, 1 extra million of French has fallen under the poverty line. That's a total of 10 million of poor people in France. The Bank of France foresees an unemployment rate over 10% for 2021. An increasing number of people are in need for food assistance and blankets, especially now in the freezing cold. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
The head of the World Health Organization has warned about a rising trend of coronavirus infections in Mexico.
The number of increase in cases and deaths is in Mexico is very, very worrisome. When it reached its lowest the week of October 12, it was around 2,000. Now by November 23, the week of November 23, it has the number of deaths has doubled from 2,000 to around 4,000. I think this shows that Mexico is in bad shape.
Tedros says the number of deaths and infections has surged in Mexico, indicating that the country is facing a serious problem. Mexico's coronavirus death toll is the fourth highest in the world. It has crossed the grim milestone of 100,000. Confirmed cases are around 1.1 million. Experts say the figures are probably much higher. Officials say most of the hospital beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients. Members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries have agreed to extend oil production cuts for another 3 months starting from January. OPEC ministers and delegates said that there would be consensus on the issue if their allies in a wide group called OPEC Plus support the move. The Iranian oil minister Bijan Namdar-Zangane also confirmed the consensus but said the meeting with OPEC Plus would be difficult and requires negotiations and patience. Sources say that Tuesday's meeting has been rescheduled to December the 3rd to give more time for discussions. In April, OPEC members agreed to cut production by 7.7 million barrels a day due to diminishing demand amid the coronavirus pandemic. But OPEC Plus countries want the output to increase. The U.S. Senate remains divided on an aid plan for the pandemic-hit economy ahead of a year-end deadline. Lawmakers have urged their Senate colleagues to reach a deal as time is running out. Both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have acknowledged the urgency of clinching a deal, but they remain divided on how much time to spend and what to spend it on. The deadlock comes despite months of negotiations. Both sides blame each other for the situation. U.S. Congress in March approved the $2.2 trillion aid package, but a number of its key provisions will expire at the end of the year. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the sacred defense era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Basically, the front lines were a place where you could easily see sincerity and warmth. Everyone had a friendly relationship with others. In that arena, some people practiced sincerity and showed their divine intentions in action. We can also refer to their spiritual qualities, their midnight tears, their dawn prayers, their monotheistic enthusiasm and love, and their indifference to material trifles, and in certain cases, we witnessed their connection with Alamul Ghaib, the unseen world. Some of those dear ones and those mystic youth, mystic in the true sense of the word, had developed such spirituality in the front lines that they could see and predict the future. They could see their martyrdom, the martyrdom of their comrades, and the event that would happen. These points exist in soldiers' biographies, and they are really important.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, it is evident that the last point existed more than the others, thanks to Islam. Of course, prominence in other areas existed thanks to religious faith as well. But in particular, the last point originated from entrusting one's heart to God, to Islam, and to religious faith. One becomes really astonished at the effect of such deep faith. For example, martyrs' mothers had such deep faith. Well, you and I do not understand motherly affection at all. No one except for mothers themselves can really understand motherly feelings. However, these mothers sent their youth to the front lines. When their children went to them to ask for their permission, they responded, "Because you are going there for the sake of Islam, you may go." When they brought them the bodies of their youth, they expressed their joy at having offered them in the way of God.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a leading nuclear scientist, was assassinated in a terrorist attack on Friday. Iran's defense ministry said the top scientist was seriously wounded after attackers targeted his car and exchanged fire with his bodyguards in the town of Absart, to the east of capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh later died from his injuries in hospital. Fakhrizadeh was Iran's most renowned nuclear scientist, who headed the Ministry of Defense's Research and Innovation Organization. His assassination prompted outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for those involved in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh to be brought to justice.
It is evident terrorism has targeted the scientific progress of the Islamic world in general, and the Islamic Republic in particular. The first and foremost reason for this hostility is our development, is our progress, is our self-sufficiency, is the strength of our fists at this very moment as we shout out loud what is just and inflict upon them the truth.
And Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemies' desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemy's malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Fakhrizadeh's name was specifically mentioned in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's presentation about Iran's nuclear program in April 2018. At the time, Netanyahu said he identified Fakhrizadeh as the head scientist in the program and urged people to remember that name.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there are, quote, serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. He urged the international community, especially the European Union, to end, quote, their shameful double standards and condemn the assassination of the nuclear scientist. Zarif was referring to a trial in Belgium where four Iranian diplomats were accused of plotting a bomb attack in Paris. One of the latest projects that Fakhrizadeh was involved in was the development of the first indigenous COVID-19 test kit. U.S. sanctions prevent Iran from accessing medicine and humanitarian goods during this pandemic. The top scientist was also supervising the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under intense scrutiny of the United Nations Nuclear Agency.
Zionism, imperialism, the whole Western blood-soaked empires that assassinate, that murder, bomb, and displace, and then justify their crimes through propaganda, just like they did throughout the colonization epoch, where what I believe is that wherever in the world there is oppression, there will be a struggle. And wherever in the world there is a struggle, we shall be there. And if they think that they are threatened, well, because they are the oppressors.
This assassination follows a not-so-secret meeting in Saudi Arabia between the Saudi foreign minister and Israeli prime minister last week. It sent another signal that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Benjamin Netanyahu see this window as their last best chance in a while to try to inflict a crippling blow on Iran. Experts believe Riyadh and Tel Aviv are seeking to complicate an already challenging course for a new U.S. team to re-engage with Iran. The U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the 2015 Iran deal in 2018. Since then, Washington carried out what it called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran and imposed massive sanctions against the country. But future President of the United States, Joe Biden, has pledged to re-engage with Iran when he becomes U.S. president in January, despite long-standing opposition from Israel.
Up until now, the EU have played the winning hand on every account as they face off with the British over a post-Brexit trade deal. Yet as the deadline fast approaches for the British to beg the EU to adhere to some kind of trade rules, desperate measures may be taken in the 11th hour of the negotiations. With many of the big players in the EU very much in favour of the bloc, the French have urged the EU chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, to remain firm and stick to the plan, compelling him to stay tough on the approach the EU takes with the British. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, recently stated that any deal is now down to the friends and partners of the EU. Yet the message Boris Johnson must understand is that the very best deal he can expect to get would still have to be less favourable than the worst conditions of staying in the EU. Otherwise, what's the point of having an EU? So is this the future that Britain truly wishes to pursue? However, it seems that the EU is fast running out of patience with the British, with Barnier almost calling it a day recently, stating that there was no point negotiating over a lost cause, as it was clear that Britain was in no mood to make any commissions with the EU. Yet it seems that the EU lead has been reassured between the lines by the British chief negotiator, David Frost, that Britain may have no choice but to align to EU requests, much to the distaste of the British. So was the real reason that the EU agreed to more talks is because the British have finally realised that they must secure some kind of deal or face the perils of being a lonely piece of land floating off the coast of Europe with no friends, a shattered economy, and left in a position facing the realisation that the notion of stronger together was coined for the EU for a real good reason. When Dominic Cummings left Downing Street with his tail between his legs, there was an air of celebration in the UK, as many people finally saw the back of a man who masterminded Brexit, yet on the other hand, breached the travel rules during the lockdown, making him public enemy number one. Yet with Cummings now gone, could this be an excuse for Boris Johnson to change his stance when it comes to negotiating with Europe, using Cummings as a scapegoat along the way for all the previous failures and weak negotiating skills against the EU, and leading Britain from his armchair in self-isolation? But the question is just how much Boris Johnson is being kept in the loop when it comes to the final rounds of talks, in particular as he is in isolation. Does the Prime Minister have the influence he may have had in person while sat at home? With the British now in a weaker than ever position since the apparent news that Joe Biden will become the next President of the United States, in particular when it comes to the handling of the situation in the north of Ireland, it seems that even as the talks near their final stages, the British are no closer to being able to come away from the talks with any hope of relying on a transatlantic trade deal, as Biden, as we all know, is a very different man from Trump. With the UK facing a very bleak Christmas and New Year due to the ongoing COVID-19 virus, as well as the notion that it may very well find itself without any trade partners come 2021, it seems that all measures must now be taken to somehow agree terms with the EU, and from there, somehow convincing the rest of the world that little Britain is worth trading with, over and as opposed to trading with the might of the European Union.
The Israeli regime finally released Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras on Thursday. Al-Akhras had refused food for over 100 days in protest against his so-called administrative detention. He is now extremely frail, but says his prolonged hunger strike, which he ended on November 8th, has paid off. Al-Akhras says his freedom is the freedom of his people and an important win over the Israeli occupation. The 49-year-old Palestinian farmer from Salat ad-Daher in the north of the occupied West Bank began his hunger strike in July. His decision to refuse food was a bid to draw attention to Israel's widely condemned use of administrative detention. His hunger strike, which brought him to the brink of death, made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Israel's gross violation of human rights against Palestinian prisoners. His refusal to eat triggered a wave of condemnation of his administrative detention. The United Nations, the European Union, many rights groups and governments called for his release. Al-Akhras was one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British Mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 1948. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it, they play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates and immediately snatched, kidnapped and taken back inside for another six-month period.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around one-fifth of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor prison conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes, but they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
The French police are one of the toughest and most brutal in Europe when it comes to the use of force, with multiple examples of this demonstrated by the likes of the Compagnie Républicaine de Sécurité, or the elite CRS, when dealing with the various waves of protests that have marred the presidency of Emmanuel Macron, and is why the French public and media have turned to real-time technology to film the brutality demonstrated by the French police and security apparatus. The resulting anger demonstrated in various protests across the country against the bill has quite rightly angered the French, who expect some form of transparency in the way their country is run, how public services such as the police deal with situations, and also important is the notion of being able to justify such use of force, which, as we saw in the US with the murder of George Floyd, only takes a moment's lapse in concentration to breach the thin blue line. With the ability to film and photograph any moment with the use of a smartphone and cameras, the French appear to want to hide the actions of the police, meaning Article 24 of the new bill now makes it illegal to distribute images of police officers on duty, especially if it may harm their physical or mental integrity. But what about the integrity of the officers themselves acting out their duties? Should that not also be something that should be open to scrutiny? A recent example of police brutality in France is the recent removal of migrants who were camping in Place de la République in Paris's 12th arrondissement, in which bystanders and witnesses described the amount of force used by the police as shocking, once again raising the question as to just what kind of security apparatus the French government wishes to deploy. But for many lawmakers in France, the introduction of the bill is also being met with some opposition, in particular within the French Parliament, with one lawmaker claiming that whilst it's acceptable that police officers should be able to complete their jobs without being threatened or harassed, at no point should public freedoms be breached, claiming that this bill may not change much at all, even when introduced. when the people took to the streets during the French Revolution, the motto following the toppling of the bourgeoisie became indoctrinated into the values that France still claim true today, namely the famous three words of liberté, égalité, and fraternité, or freedom, equality, and fraternity. Yet today, in modern France under Macron, all three of the coined terms appear to have less meaning, as the freedom to film the actions of the police in public places has been taken away. The equality between classes grows ever wider as Macron protects his elite friends from taxes at the expense of the poor. And fraternity is a joke as religious, racial and social discrimination run rife in France. The division in France has never been greater when it comes to religion, with France currently embroiled in yet another controversy as the publication of offensive cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad had been labelled as freedom of speech by Macron, much to the distaste of many who have taken to the streets around the world to protest this, and leaving religious leaders in France calling for some notion of unity, proving that Islam is a religion of peace. With Macron also causing huge division within France on other fronts, with the increase in duty on fuel sparking the Yellow Vest movement, and the failed policy on reforming the pension scheme costing the regular worker thousands of euros, it seems that with every step Macron takes, the more unpopular he becomes, with the so-called security bill just passed protecting the police, further cementing the fact. It can therefore be argued that Macron is the most unpopular president France has ever had, even surpassing the legacy left behind by François Hollande, as he divides his country, favours the elite, angers the international community, and essentially washes away his chances of being re-elected, needing a miracle over the next 2 years if he's really able to save his extremely fragile grip on his country.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Salamun alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for coming. Sister Salma Khalfan, we've been talking about the roles of the fathers in the upbringing of their children for a few episodes now. And you mentioned a few prophets from the Holy Quran, being one, Prophet Ibrahim, Prophet Yaqub, with his son, and the Holy Prophet with his daughter, Fatima Zahra alayhi salam, and also Hazrat Luqman with his son. So should we continue with that?
Yeah, in Hazrat Luqman's case, yes, we see that he's imparting wisdom and knowledge.
Okay.
Like, you know, one of the rights of the father, as we dealt with, what are the responsibilities and rights that the father should enact on the child to teach them, right?
Mm.
And then we said some other hadiths also come out from that, like to teach the child the Holy Quran, to teach, yes, the child writing. And then we also mentioned that the to teach physical things. That,
yes,
is writing,
yes,
and, you know, maybe some sports or,
true,
something that the child could remember, mm-hmm, the father by, you, mm, know. That's very important also. Mm. So here, Hazrat Luqman, who was given wisdom by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, wanted the child to also have that wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when a father, for example, is of a high status, he should want to make the child also, you know, learn some of the things that he knows, especially if it's regarding the religious aspect.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
very important.
Absolutely.
For example, we have some scholars who know so much, but they feel that the child, the children, the little children, how can they impart the, whatever they know, considering their growth state and, mm, their milestones? You can talk to the child about that,
yeah,
principle.
Yes, yes.
A child is so alert, and when, if he shows interest, he could want to learn more and more as, mm, as time,
true,
goes by, right?
Yes, yes.
So having this kind of intelligent conversations is very important for a child. Like Hazrat Luqman alayhi salam, in the Holy Quran we mention in Surah Luqman ayat number 16, he says, "My dear son, should there be anything good or bad, even me to the measure of a mustard seed, and be hidden in a rock or in the heavens, in the earth, or in the earth, Allah will bring it forth." This means alerting the son that, you know, everything will be accounted for. And we have another ayat also in Surah Zilzal,
mm-hmm,
you know, the last ayat, "فَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ خَيْرًا يَرَهُ وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ شَرًّا يَرَهُ." So for Allah, every mustard seed weight, atom weight deed will be seen,
yes,
by the person who is performing it.
So this relationship basically talks about one of the rights of the children that a father has, teaching the children, that, you know, the father,
yeah,
has,
it stands out,
the responsibility,
this kind of
teaching,
values when you teach the child stands out from the fact that the father is teaching,
yeah,
and he's performing his right.
And then the other important thing is how we teach them, like the way you said, when he says, he even shows his love and affection, he says, "Ya bunayya," he,
yeah,
says.
So besides calling his son in a lovable manner,
yeah,
Luqman also reminded him about being a humble slave throughout the life and maintain good relation with the people around him. You know, like, this is very important that you should be alert in whatever you do.
Mm.
Be very conscious of whatever you do and whatever relationships you have with the people.
Yeah. Okay, we'll continue after the break. Dear listeners, stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. We were talking about Hazrat Luqman, about verse number 16 of Surah Luqman, as to how he was teaching his son wisdom, the wisdom that the father has to be in some way taught to the children as well.
Yeah, that's yes. right. And good values.
And good values.
So there's another ayat of Surah Luqman. We have ayat number 18. He tells his son, and do not turn your cheek away from the people. Do not turn your face away from the people. And do not walk on the earth haughtily.
Yes.
Surely Allah does not like anyone who is arrogant and proud.
Yes.
So he tells his son also about this, you know, that Allah... Now, he must have seen that his son now understands, you know, that he needs to be told what to do and what not to do. Mm. Because we say that a very young child does not like to be, you know, done ordering of that, do this, don't do that. So he must have seen that his son now has come of an age that he can accept the do's and don'ts.
Mm.
So he says, and do not turn your face away from the people.
Mm.
And do not walk on the earth haughtily, that is proudly, as if you have everything, you own everything. However much you own, you have to be as humble as possible.
Okay, so you mean there is an age where we can talk to the children like that?
That's what I mentioned, that from first, a father needs to watch a child and his milestones and his growth process.
Mm.
Is he now old enough to take what he's being told?
Mm.
So this is when you can impart whatever kinds of wisdoms that you need to impart. Either you need to play with the child and make him learn at the same time. Either you need to tell him the do's and don'ts.
Mm-hmm.
Either you need to talk about, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and what are his promises, mm-hmm. his rewards, and what are the punishments, and any metaphor, you know, like of religion, yes. or good thing that you can impart on to your child.
Yes.
You need to watch the child. Yes. You need to be there for him.
Yes.
You need to be not locked up in your own world of whatever you're working
so
or
doing things at the wrong time would have the wrong effect.
Yeah, it would have the wrong effect, exactly. So sometimes, you know, a child does not want to listen because he's too small. He says, I don't want this heaven and hell. I don't want to. So this is not, or I don't want to pray. It'll become like this if you don't get them at the right moment.
True.
So you should, a father should be very alert in that way, that how is the child is growing, what messages to give him, what, for example, is too early for him right now, and things like that. So Luqman understood the importance of cultivating a good understanding between him and his son through telling him these kind of values and wisdoms, and to share this with him so that his son himself would be successful in meeting life's challenges, you know. Because usually you tell these things to your son so that, or to your child, you want them to not only cherish them and admire you for them, but you want him to pave his life successfully,
Be a good person himself.
Yeah, exactly. So the father should be very concerned about this, the way we have Luqman as a role model of a father. Stories of these fathers and their children highlight that ever crucial role of a father in the family. You know, fathers are not limited to only fulfilling material responsibilities, like them being the breadwinners only, providing for the welfare, the school fees, and the, you know, the clothing and the food and for the child or the toys. No, they should know that this role of their fatherhood is so important to take the child a long way through in this life and then in the hereafter to be successful.
I'm sure he has a very, very important role. True. Thank you, Sister Khalfan. Let's take a break, dear listeners. Stay tuned and we'll be back soon.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, one of the things that I will never leave doing until I die is greeting children, so that it becomes a tradition after me.
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sister Salma Khalfan, you mentioned four prophets. The first one was Prophet Ibrahim and his special bond with his son, and how he was attentive towards his child and the supplications that he made for his children. The other prophet that you talked about was Prophet Yaqub, and the bond and the connection that he had with his son, Prophet Yusuf, and how he was acting as an active listener. That we have to take that as a lesson, and, you know, do the same with our children. And the third prophet was Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and how he showed love and mercy towards all, especially his daughter, Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha. And we have to learn to have this love and mercy, I think, which we lack sometimes, thinking the children don't need it. But we have to show that love and mercy towards our children as well. And the fourth prophet that you mentioned was Hazrat Luqman, and how he parted his wisdom to his son, and how it's important for the fathers to part what they know to their children as well. And this has an effect on their upbringing. Yeah. And of course, the very important point that we have to keep in mind as to when and what time we should do what thing is very important, because sometimes we do, you know, tell children when they're not in the mood, or, you know, it's not the right time. So we have to look for the particular right time to have that good effect.
That's right.
If you have any last points to just add in.
Just as a reminder to the audience that Hazrat Luqman might be a very great personality, might be a wise man. Mm-hmm. Some riwayats say that he was a prophet, some say that he wasn't a prophet.
Okay.
But he was surely a role model.
That so, he was mentioned in the Holy Quran.
Exactly. Such a great book, you know, one book in one life for us to take guidance from. And he did have a lot of wisdom to impart this wisdom to his son. So imparting wisdom to your son. And now we, as the Ummah of the Holy Prophet, clearly Imam Ali alayhi salam in the tradition says, "Ana wa Aliyun abawa hadhihi al-umma." That him and Imam Ali alayhi salam are the fathers of the Ummah. So we have two fathers that we can emulate from.
Yes.
So we as parents, us mothers or fathers, we can emulate from our father figures.
True.
And that's, you know, these great personalities, the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali, and their lifestyles, how they brought up their children, how they were with the people, how they were in the ibadat, in their social life, in their spiritual life.
I think every aspect of their life is an example for us.
Yeah.
And upbringing, I think the very subtle points that we have to take from their lives, especially, you know, how they upbring their children as well.
Yeah. What maxims and hadiths do they have to give us? What wise words do they have to impart to us?
Yes.
Because they are the fathers, yeah?
Yes, true.
And of course, because it's so innate in us, in our disposition, we can take it quickly. Yeah. Especially if we are brought up with the halal way, you know, that we can accept these things faster. Inshallah, that I pray that, you know, we do become like that, inshallah.
Inshallah,
we take
inshallah
these personages as our role models.
Inshallah. Thank you very much, Sister Salma Khalfan, for your beautiful points. And thank you very much for joining us on this program, dear listeners. And if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And visit us at our website, parstoday.com, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page, Call of Islam Radio. And inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah al-kareem.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome. This is News Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're coming to you from the British capital. Now, please stay with us as we delve into the day's top stories and social media talking points. But our top story: the European Union has condemned the assassination of a top Iranian scientist. Brussels says the killing was a criminal act, but the bloc is urging all sides to practice restraint as tensions between Iran and the United States and Israel escalate once more. U.S. President Donald Trump, a staunch ally of Tel Aviv, leaves the White House in just a few weeks, and some say this might be a last-ditch attempt at provoking an escalation with Iran, as Bianca Rahimi reports.